It's time. It's time to open your eyes. It's time to open your mind. It's time to grow up and face reality. It's time to lock and load because it's Meat Trapper time. Hello everyone, and welcome to episode number 145 of Meat Trapper Radio. And I think we have an interesting show tonight. We're going to talk about a couple of things. The primary thing is we're going to talk about a real-life survival situation that I was able to witness very close hand, or very close up, this past weekend, and had a little incident myself that I'm going to share with you. And I'm not really going to have any conclusions because I like everyone to draw their own conclusions and to think for themselves. But be that as it may, before we get into tonight's show, one announcement that I can make is it looks like I'm going to be at the Western Kentucky Free Trappers School, and that'll be sometime in July, and I'll be there with Mr. Brian McKee of SouthernSnares.com. And Brian is the sponsor of this broadcast and the reason that it stays on the air, so I would very much appreciate it if you were in need of any cable, snares, baits, lures, traps, or anything of that nature. Be sure and give Brian a chance. And if you give him a call, he's a great guy to talk to. He'll tell you anything you need to know. He'll tell you straight up if he has it. If not, he'll tell you who does and where to get it. And always tell him Meat Trapper sent you. Now, before we get into the meat of the show, I had an interesting experience that I want to share with you that I think is illustrative of just how morally bankrupt our government is at virtually every level. Now, where I used to live, we did not have any traffic cameras, any speed trap cameras or red light cameras or any of that crap. And in my new abode, there are, I think there are 7 locations in the city that have a red light camera. And there was, I was on my way out of town one morning. It was a Monday, morning, very early. And the red lights in this town, they stay red for a long time. It's one of those interesting things that you notice when you move from one city to another. In the city that I used to live in, you would come to a stop and you would be there for a minute or two or three and the light would turn green, and you know, it was constantly cycling. Here it seems like they're on a much longer cycle. You can spend many minutes sitting before you get a chance to go, and then the other side has to sit and wait. And it's just interesting the way that works. But anyway, it was pre-dawn and there was nobody around, and I was getting on the interstate. And so you look, there's nobody as far as you can see. So I went on through. And so I got a little envelope in the mail. And they had a picture of my truck. And they were able to zoom in on the tag quite clearly. You know, very nice optics on the camera. Very good picture. And sent me a letter. And when you read the letter, it's interesting. It has the pictures of you committing the infraction, and it says that you have you've committed a violation and that you need to send $50 to the city, to the police department. And if you turn the letter over on the back, there's a block of text on the back, and it says something to the effect of failure to pay will not impact your driving status, your credit, or I forget how they word it. But it was a very odd little paragraph. And so it prompted me to do a little research, because I had people tell me, oh, you don't have to pay that. They can't make you pay it. And I was like, yeah, right. Well, I did some research, and guess what? Here, you don't have to pay it. Now, most people would think that's a good thing, but I'm gonna take a little bit different tact on this. This all originated, you know, with the city wanting to collect more revenue. And so what they do is they outsource the traffic cameras. The company that owns the cameras, that installs the cameras, that maintains the cameras, and that monitors the cameras, they're out of Australia. So if you get pissed off at them, it's a little bit of a drive to go complain to them. You have to drive to Australia to do it. Not many people are willing to do that. So they have a measure of safety, physical safety there. Now, the way it works is if you pay $50, the company that owns the traffic cameras, they get half right off the top. They get $25, and the other $25 goes to the police department, who did absolutely nothing to earn the money. Now, the text on the back of the letter, I did some research on that, and evidently a few years back, they sent a ticket to a guy who was not only a lawyer, but who was a state representative. And he was a freedom-loving state representative. In other words, they sent a letter to the wrong guy. And being a lawyer, he actually found that there is a specific state law here that specifically states they cannot make you pay this citation. So, basically, the police are sending out a letter telling you that you owe them $50 when they know for a fact that there is a law saying they cannot make you pay this. Now, when you get to the technicalities of it, technically, they are not breaking the law. They're just sending a letter saying, you ran a red light, and you need to send them $50. There's nothing illegal about that. But if you don't send them $50, they can't do a damn thing about it. And so this lawmaker tried to have the entire thing made illegal, the entire traffic camera thing done away with. And he was unable to get that through the state legislature because they were raking in too much money. But he was able to get a law passed that required that odd little paragraph that I mentioned printed on the back of the letter. And that's the tip-off that something's up and you don't have to pay this. Now, the thing that upset me was not that I got a violation in the mail, because I did run the red light. And you know what? When there's nobody for a mile in any direction, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm not going to sit there like a damn dumbass being monitored by Big Brother with a remote control camera. They can kiss my ass. That's the way I feel about it. You know, we've lost all common sense and judgment in this country. But the thing that really upset me was that the police are running a theft by deception scam. That's all this is. This is theft by deception. You do not have to pay, in this state, you do not have to pay these citations, yet they send a letter out insinuating that you do. And it has the police department logo, it has the officer's badge number who reviewed the videotape and the camera, and he's signed off on it, and he's sworn that it looks like a violation, and he's reviewed everything, and he's put his badge number on it, and you can go to court and contest this, you can fight this, you can do this, that, and the other. It's got all this legal crap on it. And all it's designed to do is to intimidate and scare people into paying them money when they don't have to. It's designed to buffalo them, to intimidate them, to threaten them, to bluff them. Now, if I started calling people up, or if I started sending letters out saying that you had committed some sort of infraction and that you needed to send me $50. And I put all kinds of legal-looking stuff all over it. They would come arrest me. They would put handcuffs on me and put me in a cage. They would call me a criminal. If I did the exact same thing that the police are doing, I would be a criminal. Now, the funny thing is that everybody knows about this that lives here. You know, and it was new to me. I had to learn. But everybody else just throw it in the garbage. Just throw it in the garbage. You don't have to pay that. They can't make you pay that. Throw it in the garbage. And do you see the corrosive effect this has on people's respect for the authority of governance? And this isn't the result of people losing their morality. This is the result of government losing its morality. Because every person at that police department knows this is bullshit, and they go along with it. They sign their names to it. They didn't lift a finger, and yet they rake in tens of thousands of dollars. And the people that pay this stuff are the people that can least afford it. They're the uneducated, undereducated, they're minorities who are afraid that they're going to get picked up one night and have a warrant on them and get thrown in jail because they don't understand what's legal and lawful. It's just disgusting. It's just pathetic. You know, and this kind of thing just diminishes. The thing is, it's a corrosive effect because it diminishes the respect that people should have for the law. Because it's just another indication that it's a scam and it's all about the money. And it's across the board. I mean, look at the deep state and look at the failed coup attempt against the president. I have no respect for the FBI or anybody associated with it. None. Zero. And that's not a good thing. If you work for the FBI, you can kiss my ass. And I know enough of them, believe me. I know enough of them personally. They can kiss my ass. They don't like me. But anyway, that's just it's just another nail in the coffin of the former United States of America. But anyway, let's talk about survival. Okay, let's move on. This past weekend, I was down in the Sipsey River Wilderness area of northwest Alabama, in the Bankhead National Forest, and that is absolutely my favorite place on the planet, bar none. I absolutely love the Sipsey. It's an area, several thousand acres of true wilderness area, and it's got big sections of virgin timber that have never been cut. The country is exactly the way it was before European contact. Some of it's so rugged and so remote that they never could get into to log it or develop it or anything like that. And it's just an amazing country. And so I was down there camping out. I was doing some hammock camping and backpacking, and just had a great time. I was down in the gorges and waterfall country, and this place is just covered with moss-covered rocks, and it's just verdant green, and it's just amazing. It really is. But the weather was interesting in that during the day, it was kind of hot and kind of muggy. It was about 75 degrees, 78 degrees, kind of hot and sticky. You know, humidity was high, no wind or anything like that. And so I came out of the woods and set up my camp and everything, got my tarp up, got my hammock set up, started to get everything put away. It started to rain, and rain it did. Now, the forecast was for a 40% chance of rain. So I figured I would get a shower, maybe two, but I was not expecting what happened. It was a torrential deluge. It was a downpour. And I was able to get one bar of cell service, and so it took a while to load any kind of a web page, but I finally got the radar to load out there, and I saw there was wave after wave, or line after line of red thunderstorms coming through. And, you know, it was predicted to last until, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I was like, well, I guess I better just settle in, just along for the ride, you know. And so as I kicked back in my hammock and covered up, got nice and warm, as that front moved in, the temperature started to drop. And it was windy. Rain was blowing sideways. I had the tarp really cinched down on both sides of my hammock, you know, to stay dry. Lightning was overhead, and thunder. And it was, you know, multiple lightning crashes. You know, sometimes it would light the sky up. If you've ever been out in the woods at night in pitch darkness, when lightning comes, it turns the whole place bright as day. And sometimes it would light it up for 4 and 5 seconds in a row, you know. Just incredible stuff. And off in the distance, you could hear, every once in a while, you could hear a tree or a big limb come down, you know. And so it was raining so hard, it was hitting the tarp so hard that it was hard to sleep because it was so loud at times. But finally, next morning, sun comes up. I step out of my hammock, and there's about 2 inches of water on the ground. I mean, it was soaked, man. And it had gotten chilly. It had turned chilly. It was down in the 40s, and you had wind, and it was damp and all of that. So I was drying my gear out and breaking camp and all that kind of stuff. Got back to the trailhead, and the pickup truck pulled up. And there was a guy in there, pulled up alongside me, and he asked me, he said, you been down towards the Randolph Trailhead? And I said, no, I've been over here by Kenlock is where I've been. And he told me, he said, well, he said, I'm the incident commander for Winston County Search and Rescue, and we've got an elderly man that's gone missing in the woods. And I was like, uh-oh. And so we started talking, and he said, yeah, the guy, he's 70 years old. He's got hearing issues, and he's had seizures before in the past, and he came up for a day hike from Birmingham, and he was supposed to be home last night, and he never came home, and his wife called it in. We've located his vehicle down at the Randolph Trailhead, and I was just curious if he'd been hiking out there. And I said, no, I've been on this end down here. And so anyway, he said, well, and I told him, I said, I was out here last night, and I said, brother, it was some rough weather. I said, it rained, torrential rain. And I said, after that front moved through, that temperature dropped like a rock, and it got cold, you know. And he said, yeah, I know. And so anyway, he went on about his business, and I started packing my stuff up. And come to find out, I did a little research when I got back, and the guy's name was Sid Burgess. He's 70 years old. He's a retired Presbyterian minister and one of these, you know, liberal, you know, ministers, inner city liberal churches or whatever. But when I was home, I was talking to some of my buddies. I was talking to Chip and Clint and them, and I said, I really am going to be surprised if that guy makes it. Because I said, I was out there, and man, I would not have wanted to be exposed to the elements under those conditions. And what it is, it prompted a little discussion between us about what it would take to die of hypothermia. What kind of conditions would you have to encounter that could you survive, and under what circumstances? And, you know, the thing is, people don't understand hypothermia. You can go hypothermic when the air temperature is 50 degrees. You can go hypothermic in water if the water temperature is 70 degrees. And so when people go out on day hikes or go camping or backpacking, and they see, you know, temps, you know, in the 40s at night and 70s during the day, they're thinking perfect weather, and they're not thinking that you could get into serious trouble in those conditions, but you absolutely can. And all it takes is one slip and fall. When I was hiking out, I've been nursing a bad knee. I slipped and turned an ankle on the way out, and you know, it didn't break or anything, but it got me to thinking, what if I had broken a leg? What if I had been backpacking and I was off trail and broken a leg? Maybe a compound fracture. I got a bone sticking out of my thigh. I'm certainly not going to walk out. You know, I'm not going to pull out my hatchet and build a shelter. You know, and then we have weather conditions come in where it's tornadic activity and torrential rain. And, you know, you gotta think about these things. You know, how would you handle a situation like that where you can't really move and you're out for a day hike? What do you carry on a day hike that would enable you to survive until somebody comes along and finds you? You know, and as we were talking, Clint, if most of y'all know him, you know, he's a combat vet, Army guy, you know, former military. And one of his postings, he had two postings that we talked about. One was in Alaska, and then one was here in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And he made a very interesting statement. It really threw me for a loop, really made me think. He said, you know, the entire time I was stationed in Alaska, I never saw one soldier go hypothermic. Not one. And he said, when I was at Fort Campbell in Kentucky, it happened all the time. You would see people start to shiver and chatter, and then their mental faculties start to fade and poor judgment, and they start doing really, really stupid things. And that really, you know, I really stopped to think about that. It was like, because your initial reaction is Alaska is a much more harsh environment than Kentucky. But maybe it's because people, when you're in Alaska, you're aware of the harshness of the environment. You're prepared for it, and you're not as lackadaisical as you might be in a place like Kentucky, where it's not nearly as harsh as an environment, but the conditions can change, and you're out expecting 70 or 75 degree weather. Something happens, you fall, you slip, you hurt yourself, you can't get out. It starts pouring rain, you get soaking wet, maybe you fall into a creek or something like that. Then the winds pick up, the temperature drops, you've got a little fanny pack on because you were out day hiking, and now you're in a real pickle. You know, you're in a real situation. But back to Mr. Burgess's story, they located his vehicle at the trailhead that evening, but because of the severe weather with tornado warnings out and the driving rain and all of that, they couldn't put men into the woods because it was simply too dangerous. So they had to wait until the next morning when the weather broke to go in and look for him. And they searched and searched, and days went by with no word. And they finally brought in, I think it was on day number 3, when an outside search and rescue team with tracking dogs and all of that came in, and they were able to find him. And I think they found him on day 4, because I was following it on Facebook every day, checking updates, you know, 2 and 3 times a day. And when they found him, evidently he had climbed up under a rock ledge and stayed out of the rain, stayed out of the weather, which is probably what saved his life. He had taken a little bit of food with him in his day pack, and he was rationing his food. He still had a little bit of food left. He had been drinking the water out of the creeks, and he was too weak to stand up and walk, so they had to stretcher him out of the wilderness, which took quite a while. And then once they got him back to the trailhead, they were able to land a helicopter and medevac him out to the hospital. And I was stunned that the guy was alive, because after 4 days, I was like, man, somebody that old, you know. I'm glad he made it. You know, I'm glad he was alive. And I often wonder, I did a little research on him and looked him up on Facebook and on the internet, and you know, he was obviously a liberal Democrat, and I just wonder if his view of conservative deplorables is going to change any after it was the conservative deplorable Trump-supporting men that went in and carried him out of the woods and then flew him in a helicopter back to an urban area. I don't know. Not that that really matters, but it was something that crossed my mind. Because recently there was just another incident out in California where two hikers became lost. They were out there 4 or 5 days before, you know, the rescue crews went in and got them and life flighted them out and all of that. It's just interesting that you can look at these people's pictures. You know, you can tell if somebody's a liberal or conservative by looking at them. You ever notice that? You know, the way they dress, the way they wear their hair, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You can tell kind of clothes they're wearing. And it seems like it's, you know, it's never Bubba the going catfishing that has to be rescued from the wilderness. You know, it's always Biffy and Buffy, and the people doing the rescuing are always the deplorable types, you know. But be that as it may. So, but the other thing I wanted to mention was a couple of books. If you're interested in this subject, you know, real world survival and everything, there are two books that I can absolutely, without reservation, recommend. And they're two different ends of the spectrum. The first book is sort of a hands-on physical type book, and it's called 98.6, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, and it's written by Cody Lundeen. Now, if you remember the reality show Dual Survival, it had Cody Lundeen and Dave Canterbury on it, you know, and Cody was the long-haired hippie guy that didn't wear any shoes, you know, and he was always in the nature mumbo-jumbo and all of that, you know, and Dave was the short-haired, you know, military guy that was, you know, going to go out and kick ass and take names and all of that kind of stuff, and the producers of the show did a great job. I liked the show. I thought it was entertaining to watch. But the producers did a great job of playing off these two different philosophies, you know, the get along with nature and the crush nature and survive. And, I think they did a great job of that. So I always enjoyed watching the show, even though we all know it was contrived and staged and all of that. But Cody's book, it's a good book, and the central thesis of his book is simply, if you can keep your core body temperature at 98.6 degrees, you're going to survive. And it doesn't matter if it's cold outside or if it's hot outside. You have to insulate yourself from the environment and maintain that core temperature. And he goes, you know, he has a lot of really good stuff in the book. I read this book many, many years ago, and it really changed my ideas about survival kits, because I did a video a while back called Why I Don't Carry a Survival Kit. And what I was doing is I was poking my finger in the eye of all these people that want to carry these Altoid tin survival kits with, you know, some fish hooks and all this shit. They want to, you know, And Cody's survival kit was about 3 or 4 pounds. And really what it was his everyday usage gear. And that's what I did the video on, was I carry a using kit, not a survival kit. You know, I don't officially declare, hey, we're having an in-flight emergency, it's time to crack open the survival kit and get some fish hooks and survive. You know, no, it's about keeping that core temperature, you know, having some rain gear, having the ability to purify water, make a fire, you know, find direction, having a knife to cut stuff, you know, that sort of thing. And when you get into all of that, instead of going and doing the tin foil space blanket stuff just because it folds up nice and neat and doesn't take up much space, if you actually get out and use it, you realize you need to actually have something that works and is rugged and substantial. Because when you've got a broken leg and you're laying down and it's torrential rain, you need a poncho that you can put on, sit up against a tree, light a candle, put it between your legs, and create that chimney effect and ride that night out. And you're not going to do that with some little cheap crap, you know. But Cody's book is really good in that regard. And he goes into a little bit of the biology or physiology of what happens when you get dehydrated. And he's talking about how your blood thickens up and it causes your heart to work harder. And, you know, you're more fatigued and you can't push as hard and all of this kind of stuff. And it really, having that knowledge in your head really helps, because if you do start to go hypothermic or if you do start to get overheated, you can recognize those symptoms in your body. And you can take steps to short-circuit them by not pushing yourself as hard, by slowing down a little bit. And so I find that kind of stuff very valuable, because when something starts to happen to me, I can rationalize what's happening and say, okay, the reason why I'm getting out of breath, the reason that I'm getting fatigued is because I'm dehydrated, and what that's causing is this, this, and this. So I need to just slow down a little bit, you know. The other book that I think is a great book, and it's much more cerebral. It has nothing to do with physical survival kits or knives or anything like that. This is all mental stuff. And it was by Lawrence Gonzalez, and it's called Deep Survival. And what deep survival is about is the psychology of survival. And he does a lot of stuff, and he goes in and looks at incidents and where people that are trained outdoorsmen die in a situation, but a four-year-old child survives for days. And he says, how can this happen? How can somebody who's trained and has gear not make it, and then somebody who has no experience or no knowledge whatsoever make it? And, you know, and so he goes into the great detail of this stuff. And, you know, not to spoil the book or anything, because it is a good book, but he talks about, for instance, understanding what's going on in your mind, just as Cody talks about understanding what's going on in your body. Gonzalez talks about what's going on in your mind. And for instance, when you get turned around, when you get lost, you step off the trail, you get bumfuddled or whatever, the natural reaction is to panic. The natural reaction is to panic. You're lost. You don't know where you are. You don't know how to get back to the trail. And you start moving fast. The natural reaction is to start running or blundering through the woods. Now, this is physiological fact. It's why all the old woodsmen and all the old survival books would say, stop, sit down on a rock, you know, smoke you a cigarette. That's back when you could smoke cigarettes, you know. take your time, chill out, you know, settle down a little bit. All of that. And what they're trying to do is break that cycle of panic or break that cycle of fear. And so deep survival goes into, why does that panic and fear happen? Because it's an involuntary response. It's in the animal part of your brain. It's not something that you can control, or it's not something that you don't deliberately make a decision to say, hey, it's time to panic and it's time to start running around in circles. Nobody does that. Nobody consciously makes that decision, but you feel it building within you. And what he explains is you live your entire life with your brain processing imagery from your eyes. And your brain processes these images, and your brain associates these images to wherever you are. You're in your house. You're in your car. You're outside of your house. You're in the woods. You're on a trail. You're beside a creek or a river. And your brain knows everything is okay. I know where I am. I'm not lost. I'm on the trail. And this is what it looks like to my eyes. And the images coming in through my eyes and into my brain, these are valid images. They're comforting images. And I can process this, and it all makes sense to me. Where I am in the world right now makes sense. I'm in control. Now, when you step off the trail and you get turned around, and all of a sudden you look around and you realize you have no idea which way to walk in, what's happening is all of a sudden, the imagery coming in through your eyes, being processed by your brain, doesn't fit a known pattern. It doesn't fit any known imagery that matches a known safe location on the planet. And your brain craves that security. Your psyche desperately needs to know where your body is and to know that everything is okay. And it can't match any of the sights coming through your eyeballs. It can't match it up to any known safe space, such as a trail or a trail marker or a creek or any or your home or anything like that. And so your brain needs to match a pattern, a visual pattern. Your brain needs to make that match and put itself back in order so that everything is right in the universe and you're in a known place. And so what your brain tells your body is to start moving and find me that match. Go find that match. Move, move, faster, faster. Go. I need a match. I need a match. Look, what about over there? Look that way. What about that way? Well, let's try here. Well, let's try there. And you see, that's why people panic when they get lost. That's what's happening. And once you read a book and you understand this, when the next time you do step off the trail and get turned around, and you realize you have no idea which way to walk, and you feel that first twinge, you go, "All right, dude, chill out, man. I know you're trying to match a pattern. All right, I know what's going on. I got this, okay? Just calm down. I'm going to find you a visual that's going to make some sense. Just, okay? Just chill out, dude. Chill out, brain." And so I thought that was an excellent book. And he also talks about solving the problems in front of you rather than planning out a survival strategy. That's like what I was talking about. If you slipped and broke your leg and it started raining, you know, instead of trying to plan out a long-term strategy, you know, what is right in front of you right now? What problem do you have to solve right now? So anyway, that's what was on my mind tonight, and that's how I spent my weekend. And I really enjoy going down there. There's a place down there, and let me mention this because this sort of helps me go back in time a little bit. And that is, if you're ever down around Moulton, Alabama, Northwest Alabama, on Highway 33, there's a little establishment on the side of the road called the Warrior Mountain Trading Company. I believe that's what it's called. Yeah, Warrior Mountain Outfitters, Warrior Mountain Trading Company. And it's a neat little place. It's got a little gas pump out front so you can get some gas. And when you pull up to the place, they've got a long front porch that goes all the way across the front of the store. So it's got some rocking chairs and a couple picnic tables out there. And when you walk in, they've got, you know, the usual snacks and stuff that a convenience store has. But they also have a magnificent book selection. A lot of Indian books and hiking books and moonshining books and plant identification books, all that kind of stuff. Really neat stuff. They've got a little short order kitchen back there. You can fix you a cheeseburger or some fries or something, you know. But when I pulled up on my way down this weekend, it was turkey season, and there were a couple old fellas, you know, all camoed up. They're sitting in the rocking chairs out there. It's about noon or so. And they all had their shotguns leaning up against the side of the store. And, you know, that's when you really appreciate being in the rural South, you know, the deep South, where you can pull up you can pull off the side of the road, pull up into a parking lot into a store, and there's guys with shotguns hanging out on the front porch. And as I walked by, I looked at them. I said, y'all been slaying them turkeys? And that started the conversation. So we sat there and we talked for, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. And I went on in, and I always buy a book. Every time I go through there, I do them a courtesy. I buy a book. It's always an interesting book, you know. Bought one on the CCC. I'm going to do an episode on the CCC. I learned a lot from that book. But then on my way out, you know, stop and talk to them again. And it's just, it's a way of life that is vanishing, to where men can simply spend some time sitting in rocking chairs out on a front porch with a 12-gauge shotgun, camouflage, and just talk to total strangers like they've known them their entire life. And you just don't get that much anymore, you know? That's rare. And that's just one of those things that makes the whole thing worthwhile, you know? So anyway, I hope this was useful, and I hope it gives you pause for thought. If you have any feedback you'd like to share, either leave it in a comment or mail it to me, email me, meattrapper@gmail.com or meattrapper@protonmail.com. Oh, and also the Wild Man books are back in stock. You can go to meattrapper.com, click on Poaching Manual, and you can order it using PayPal, and I'll ship it right out to you. And it's a great book. I really like the book, and it's funny. One of the listeners here, Patreon listeners, he reads a chapter to his kids every night at bedtime as the bedtime story. And I thought that was pretty cool, because each chapter is just 2, 3, 4 pages, something like that. Each one's a little incident, entertaining and educational in each one. And whether you're shotgunning turkeys or slingshotting bullfrogs, you know, he's done it all. And it really is a cool book. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. I hope it was useful, and we'll see you next time.